on step number two tonight, which is came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. So Tom, ready to hear what you have to say.
Hey, Greg. Can you let somebody else in from Zoom?
There we go.
Thank you. Good evening. I brought some notes tonight. Last week I forgot. I guess I did okay too, so we'll see. I'm Tom Hoffman. I'm an alcoholic. If I live till July 5th this year, I'll have 47 years of continuous sobriety. These steps are tough. You talked me into something, pal. You know, unfortunately for myself, my activity is slowed down with my age, and I'm halfway ashamed of it. But I was sitting back there thinking, if my sponsor ever said anything, he said, "You're a power of example, and you have to do it." And boy, he meant it. And I mean it now, too. I don't know if we'll get into this we'll see how it goes. Came to believe a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. I had a lot of trouble with the sanity part. My earthly touches with came from an uncle who spent his lifetime in North Warren, and so I was taken down there at age 10. Now that was in the 50s, 40s. So Warren was a nut house. It was a real nut house at that time. They didn't have the medications for people. They didn't have all those things. And for a 10-year-old to get familiar with that and now tired to speak on the fact on the subject is entirely out of this world. But when I look at some of my drinking and the way I went about it, I can't help but look back and say, no, there's a lot of insanity in those parts there that shouldn't have been. I go back to the day before we got married. Maybe even before that, let's go before that. When I graduated from high school, we had a group called the Chieri Club. It's put on by Bishop Watson. And the ultimate purpose of the thing was to get boys and girls 18 and over a place to enjoy themselves with each other and hopefully cultivate some Catholic marriages. And back then you could do that. Bell just blew my mind here. Anyhow, we did a lot of things. I ended up the president and all this and that. But back at that time, you could go to New York State and drink. And I never did. I was a sissy, I guess. It always frightened me, the fact that I'd get on Route 20 and somebody'd pull me over and I'd have to spend up a night in jail. Hell, I can't even take an x-ray, let alone stay in jail. But, so I avoided any trip to New York State with the bunch. Didn't really start drinking till I was 21. One big episode that I can remember is what I spoke about a minute ago with the night before our wedding. The fellows took me out to, I don't know what was on 8th Street, whether it was the Eagles or the Elks, but I got hammered and this is kind of dumb, just prior to that, I had a whole new set of upper and lower teeth put in. Now, I'm 21 years old. I shouldn't have happened then, but I did. Anyhow, I got drunker than a skunk, went home to bed, I got up the next morning late, couldn't find my teeth, and I was to get married in an hour or two, whatever it was. So there's a tad of insanity in stuff like that. And it's what you have to look at, or what I had to look at to see what was going on with my insanity. Because I tended to negate the thought of it. When I was looking, oh my goodness, I looked through the 12 and 12, and Bill sees it, and the big book to try to put together something that made some sense for me. And my memory is shorter than a lot of things, and I have to do things in a different constructive way, I guess. Anyhow, we got on from the marriage, and married in January. Our first son came in November, November 22nd. And I always say that my aunts and uncles always counted the months there. Back then, you didn't do that unless you went to 6 o'clock mass for a wedding and were dressed in brown and all sorts of things. Today it's a kind of an accepted thing. But Tommy, our oldest one, came along November 22nd, 1962. That would be our first Christmas together and our first Christmas for our son. Little package and oven. But he was the first great-grandson, and so that put a twinkle in everybody's eye. Back then, we had Christmas at our house, and we did. Went over to my mother-in-law's and had Christmas with her. We lived a block apart from each other, and her grandfather lived in the center of that block, so we were very close to each other. I'm coming to something. Give me a minute. Went down to my mother-in-law's, had Christmas there, traded gifts and that sort of stuff. Then walked up the street to Grandpa's, where the Christmas celebration really was. They were from the old country, a town called Penn-a-Piedmont, where the Penn Club used to be, if anybody drank there. They set up the Penn Club. And the whole family was there. Grandma, Grandpa, my mother-in-law, her sister, her brother, the family, everybody, a lot of people. And especially with the new baby, why, that was a big treat. But Grandpa did a couple of things on that day, well, throughout his life, really. But in May or June of the prior year, he would find Bing Cherry with a stem on. Nice big Bing Cherry. He'd get as many as he could and he'd put them in pint jars. Some of them in quarts. He'd take his moonshine and pour it over it. Fill that jar up with moonshine and add a touch of cinnamon, sugar. And that sat and stewed until Christmas. And it was a delightful treat, I'll tell you. It was great. And I, again, made a fool of myself with those damn things. They were just like eating M&M, for goodness sakes. And when you've got this disease, anything like that is great. But in addition to that, we made wine. And so we had homemade wine to deal with. That came at the dinner table, and always 4 ounce glasses and a 16 ounce pitcher to deal with. But I didn't waste any time with the wine either. I made sure that I got my share plus. So the day went on, and Grandpa gave out his cigarettes to the man and a $5 bill to the ladies, and forget what he gave the kids. But anyhow, the day went on, and I was drinking way too much. But I got tired after Grandpa's. So I told my wife, well, rather than go up to Mom and Dad's to see what goes on there, let's go home and I'll take a little nap. Well, I passed out. I went right out on the couch. And as I look back, the insanity part of that really strikes home when you think of a wife that's got a brand new baby sitting there saying, what the hell am I doing with this guy drunk on my couch, and my life is supposed to be roses. We're just married a year, not even a year. So that gave me a twinge of insanity, of insanity in my life. I committed the program, and I told you this last week, in February of 1974. I did fine. I stayed sober, didn't take a drink, and all that stuff. July 4th, I went down to help Carol's grandpa out, which was halfway down the block. Grandpa was up in years then anyhow, and I was painting for him. I was painting his house. I got up on the 32-foot ladder up on top painting the eaves, and for some reason I felt like I needed a drink, I guess. I don't know what possessed me, but I come down, and this is a hot July 4th day. I went down the street to my mother-in-law's, where my wine was, got myself a pint jar, filled it up, and went up the street, and drank quite a bit of it before I even touched the pint jar. So, steaming hot day, me half hammered, going up that damn ladder, and my wife at home, watching babies. Well, I had been doing quite well, and our marriage was having a lot of rocky spots in it. But in that, I really drank too much on a hot day. 4 ounces would have been too much, but I drank a hell of a lot more than that. And I went up home, and I must have been dumb enough to take that damn pint jar with me, which was real ignorance, but I did it. Well, by then I had been talking to my sponsor every day, Bob Nesbitt. He had 30-some years in then. And Carol, God love her, had presence of mind enough to talk to Bob before she chopped my head off. Bob, and I was passed out in the bed. Bob told her to take that jar, set it right next to me, and put my 24-hour book on top of it, or it on top of the 24-hour book. Because the 24-hour book was my religion at that point. I didn't miss a day looking at it, reading what it had to say and seeing how it fit into yesterday and today. So she did that. I got up, and as I said, things were a little rocky. And I held my head down for the whole damn day. But again, it's the insanity of this damn disease that led me to that. Why would I even have to do that if I didn't have a disease that made me do it? As we went on in our life, we went through some counseling and the like, and we did have a separation for a few months. At that point, I had been working with the guys out at Serenity West, but I've been sober since that date. But at that point, I was working with the guys out there, and guy I met, who is still a friend today, and I trust him with my soul, Jim, let me come in and rent a room from him. And we did a lot of things to keep us sober. Big thing was the club. And I know there's varying opinions about the club. I tend to love it. I've abused it, because I went for years without even paying a membership, not thinking. But I was of the mind that hell, they don't charge me to ask me for a membership card. I'll just come in. And that's not fair to the club, but the club has done an awful lot for a lot of guys and gals now. Things have begun to sparkle. When I came in, Carol King was the only woman around. There was only one black man around. And that's all come a step ahead now, way ahead. But we all found refuge in the club, and quite often there was a guy or a gal going to a meeting in Akron or Meadville or somewhere. So you'd hop on and go with them. Actually, it's kind of the way my sponsor did it with me at that first and second and third meeting. He took me out to Edinburgh and out to Waterford, but it gave him a chance to talk to me and to see where I was at with my game. But all those little incidents, and there's a ton more, show me that insanity doesn't just exist in Warren, Pennsylvania. I have my own, and there's a lot of it out and around. But how long it took me to realize that is this for me, I hope?
Yes, it is.
Told you Fritz Evanoff's story last week about the pickle and the cucumber. And I don't know when I changed from a cucumber to a pickle, but I did it at some point along my sober life. When I put that into my conversation here, I'm thinking of coming to believe that a power greater than myself will restore us to sanity. I really didn't have much of a problem with a power greater than myself. Being born a Catholic and in a Catholic home, going through Catholic grade schools and high schools, having a well-faced family, if you want to call it that. So I didn't have a problem believing that there was a power greater than I. And I proved it to myself in many, many ways. As I said, we broke up a little bit, and my prayer life had to increase. I existed with a rosary. I was working on the highway, I drove on Monday, usually 300-400 miles, and then come back on Friday that same mile. Paved hell a mile with a rosary in my hand. And it was the way I touched my God to make sure that I stayed sane, because I knew other things were going wrong all around me. When I was out of town, I would go to Mass early in the morning. It was a unique experience. I'd also go to an AA meeting, which was a unique experience. I like to think and kind of express that the further away you get from Akron, the vision changes with AA. And the meetings change a little bit, but the steps are all the same. Everything else is right, or the same. But things change just a little bit. When I think of that, I think of the four absolutes: honesty, purity, love, and unselfishness. That will stay in this area, it seems, but go down to Philadelphia, I don't know what you're talking about, or Massachusetts or wherever, which I did. I did a lot of traveling, and I left on Monday, come back on Friday. And meanwhile, my wife was diapering boys, trying to teach school at St. Paul's, doing things that were kind of, if you want to call it her job, but doing it alone. Because I'd go to Philadelphia or Massachusetts or wherever and hire 15 people and have a carpenter and a plumber and an electrician and all this stuff trying to remodel a store in 4 weeks or 8 weeks. So I was busy doing that kind of stuff. And it's hard to not pray when you're in that position. I did a lot of praying, got to a lot of masses, but I got tired of that after a while, and I think I did that for 8-10 years. There's a real blank space in my mind about a lot of this, but I had remembered that Monsignor Gannon, the pastor of St. Andrew's Church, and my pastor, once or twice a year would talk about the Carmelites in Erie, that his uncle, Archbishop Gannon, brought those ladies here for a purpose, so that they could pray for him. He put them in a nice little convent out on East Core Road. Monsignor used to brag about getting the bell off of a train for them to have for a bell to ring. He had so many great stories, but his words were, if you want anything done, anything, you go up there and ask those girls. Ask those nuns. All they do is pray for you. And it is, that's all they do. Morning, noon, and night, they don't eat meat. We have a fig tree in my backyard, and my son and I get the biggest treat out of taking the first load of figs up there, knowing that they're vegetarians, and they had a ball, just one fig at a time, I guess. But up until last year, at the end of the first of this year, they've had to leave town because the Pope said so. They got down to, I think, 4 or 5 nuns, and it broke my heart. It really broke my heart. Because when I made the decision to get off the road and come home and be a father and a husband and the like, I decided to go up there and ask them. So I went up, and of all the people I spoke to was Mother Aurelia. She was the head honcho up there, and she answered the door that time. And for those of you that don't know, you entered in a small hallway with Archbishop Gannon's picture at the end. There was a large tube, like, on one side, and it looked like a speaker in the wall, but it was just a covered fancy thing so that you could talk through it. The drum was made so that you could drop money on there, my figs, or however you wanted, whatever you wanted to do, but it turned around and you couldn't see them, they couldn't see you. So I went in and asked Mother, I told her, I needed a job back home. I said, I've had this job for a long time, I'm not raising my family properly, and I would like a job back home. And I said, you know, Sister, what I'd really like is a little business of my own. Now, Monsignor tells me you pray, and they did. She said, just go ahead, go home, come back when you feel like it. I said, no, I'll join you every Saturday morning for Mass, which I did. And that was always a neat affair, 8 o'clock in the morning. Why? For a while I went up by myself, and then for another while, my old aunts wanted to go and my mother wanted to go, so we made a troop going up to Carmel. And I knew all along that they were working hard at me, making sure that I got something. Well, it finally came to a point where I had taken the test at the civil service test at the welfare office, and I was invited to work down there. I got an interview down there. The executive director told me I was okay. I can come in here and tell your boss it's done. You're done. Yada yada yada. So I did that. On the next Monday, I think, I don't know. And they called me the next day and said, you can't have a job. You didn't score high enough. Now here I am working in Pittsburgh with a company car, and what the hell am I going to do? I worked for years at Eckerd's Drugs. And so I groveled and got my job back. No problem. But the next week they called me again and said, now you have a job. I said, okay, send me that on a letter that I can have a piece of paper with it. Because I just didn't need that, my goodness. I was old enough not to have that kind of issue in my life. They did, and I worked for them. So that was my job back home. And I had to look at it that way. Way back when I first started coming in here, they always said, watch what you pray for. You're going to get it. Watch it, because you do. You get the damn thing. But it's nowhere near what you thought it was going to be. And let me tell you what my little business was. It was nowhere near what I thought it would be. St. Andrews was going to start a bingo game. And they needed somebody to run the kitchen. I could barely boil an egg. But I said, come on, I'll do that. And we'll get together. So I put this plan together to how to work the kitchen in St. Andrews. And we had the usual fare, hamburgers, hot dogs, pies, cakes. We always had a dinner. We had two dinners. We had a spaghetti dinner and either a chicken or cream chicken on biscuits or some kind of thing. But I had two dinners that I could serve. Siebenberger Club was alive and selling dinner for, I think, $1.99 or $2.99 then, something like that. I said, hell, I can do that. So I did it. Everybody said, you're nuts. And I was nuts, but it worked. It did work. And within that conversation to Mother Rudia, I said, I have to have something that makes the whole family happy. I can't come home and just be an ogre businessman. I would like something that keeps my family together and makes it good. Well, that opening night, I sat at the one end next to my mother, who made all the pies. She'd come in with 10 pies on a Monday night. I don't know how the hell she did it, because she had to limp around and scoot around. She had a hard time there. Looked down the line, a friend of mine was there making Mexican sundaes. He was from Mexico. My dad was there serving pop. My mother-in-law and her cousin, or my wife's aunt, were back there handling the spaghetti meatballs. Actually, it was ziti, it wasn't spaghetti. And I think my sister was there taking care of the other meal. Her son-in-law was at the grill frying hot dog hamburgers. Her daughter was doing dishes. And my family had everybody together. It was wonderful. And it was a prayer answered. But as I said a minute ago, you got to watch what you pray for, because you're going to get it, but never what you thought it was going to be. Those nuns have provided me with a life that's really great. And I do so miss them, but I don't know whether they'll come back or not. They're all over the world. My sister worked in Africa for a year, and she ran into a bunch down there in Africa and somewhere. So they do their work. They did a great job for Bishop Cannon. And he knew that would happen. I suppose now the bishop has to figure out what to do with all that property on Fort Road. But, I think I'm getting stuck. So I think what I'm going to do is stop where I'm at, because I've got stuff to go next week on about the same subject here.
Okay.
So I'll edit for that. Okay? Thank you very much. I guess we're supposed to see if you've got any questions.
All right. Thank you, Tom. So yeah, if anybody here in the room has a question, go ahead and raise your hand. If you're on Zoom and you have a question, please feel free to just unmute yourself and go ahead when you're ready. So who would like to get us started?
Good evening, everybody. My name's Judy. Tom, it's a pleasure to see you again this evening.
Pleasure to see you.
You are quite the scoundrel, aren't you?
Well,
I really have enjoyed your talk.
Oh, thank you.
My question is, did you find your teeth?
Yes, I did. they were in under the bed with all the dust bunnies.
Oh my gosh. Well, I've lost my teeth in sobriety, so don't feel bad, darling. All right.
I believe that.
Delightful, Tom, delightful. Thanks. You certainly came across with a very good description and understanding of insanity. So God bless you for that. Nice job.
Thanks.
Thank you so much for sharing, Tom.
Oh, thank you.
Hi, everyone. I'm the other half of Tom, Carol. You did a good job, honey.
Oh, good.
I also wanted to take just a moment to say hello to everyone. And he occasionally still loses his teeth. And we have to hunt them. I also wanted to say hello to my son, Matthew, who I haven't seen in a year and a half, so I think he disappeared. But just wanted to let him know I love him. And I better start supper, huh?
Yeah. I'll be home in a while.
Okay.
Thanks.
Hi, Mom. I'm right here. And hi,
okay. Pat.
First of all, thanks for the invite. I really appreciate it. I even got teared up, damn it. But
you're a Marine. You don't do that.
Yeah, no, it's good. I want to tell you that I have cherries in my fridge right now. And I have limoncello in my fridge right now. I do enjoy a drink every once in a while. I can't tell you the last time I was drunk, but it made me laugh. It made me smile because I have cherries that my family just picked in a mason jar in my refrigerator that every once in a while when we have friends over, we enjoy it and we actually talk about that incident that my dad just talked about. So it makes me smile. So thank you.
Thank you, Matt. Glad to be here.
Who else has a question for Tom? Kevin's got a question for Tom.
I was out of that.
Yeah, you promised me that.
Thanks, Tom. Thanks for bringing all that up today. When we're talking about step two, and we talk about the definition of insanity being the same, trying to do the same thing over and over again. Maybe you could go into a little bit of that, of maybe a couple of the different things that you thought would work that maybe didn't work, and when that realization came that it didn't.
Wow. So much in my life got screwed up that I don't know how the hell to unscrew it. I don't know if I told you last week about the wine and dinner table. Did I? You remember?
A little bit, yeah.
There was that, and making the wine was a treat. We did this in Grandpa's basement. He used Muscatel grapes and Alicante grapes. No sugar. He tried Erie grapes, Northeast grapes, and you had to have sugar, and he didn't like that. So we crush the grapes, press the grapes, and so on. The crushing process was actually an apple crusher, which you cranked by hand. Okay. Now, remember, we're talking a few years back. Grandpa had a washing machine motor and said, "I God, that'll make that work," and it did. But those grapes would fly out of there like Blitzen. In his basement, he had built a press. It was a cement block that was about 3 foot square. It had a rim around, a gully around it, about an inch and a half deep, that a basket would sit in, and when the grapes were squeezed, the juice went right down there and in and out the spigot. After we crushed the grapes, we shook them out a little bit to get rid of some of the stems. And that's another thing. Mr. Del Porto brought grapes around folks back then. And they always wanted the first pick because that had less and less leaves in it. So anyhow, we would do that, and then we had 5 gallon buckets of we would fill with grapes that were just crushed. Pour them into that thing, and it was a basket about, oh God, that big around and probably that tall. We would put one bucket in, and I think about another bucket, put a steel plate on top of that, another two buckets, another steel plate, another two buckets, and another steel plate. On the outside of that thing, there was a frame just about that tall. This was a piece of railroad track right up here. These things going down the side were quarter inch angle irons, two of them, side by each, bolted together. The bottom was bolted through the cement. That was done when he put the cement in. Then we picked up a house jack and put it on top of that last pile of grapes we had, and we pumped those things until you got a bunch of grapes about that big. You could hold it in your hand. But that was the first process. To get sugar for it, he took the juice, the first juice, and as we were pressing, we were filling 5 gallon or 50 gallon barrels with juice. But along with that, once we got enough to fill, some of you remember the old copper wash boiler, this deep. I think it held 30 quarts or 30. I don't know, held a lot. Anyhow, once we got enough juice to fill that up, it went on to the stove down in the basement. But it wasn't—it was one of those hot plates that they used years ago with gas. That was full when we put it on there, and it will reach a point as it went down and cooked that it would just burst right over, and that was sugar. So, and he knew that. He knew when it happened and all that stuff. I had no idea. But that was the sugar we used for the wine. Once we got the wine into a barrel where it was going to be, then we would pour kind of a quart at a time of that stuff in there. So it would work, and the stuff would work, and stuff would come out, but it gave any sweetness it needed to the wine. I'm trying to think of what the hell else happened. When it was done, those little patties of crushed grapes, why we took out to the yard, out to the garden, and used it for fertilizer. But you really had to break it up bad, because after the first press, he would press it a total of 3 times. So by that last press, you had nothing but skin and bones. But he got maybe a quart, maybe a pint, maybe a gallon out of it. So they were down to nothing. They were just big pies of grape leavings. But that's kind of a story of the craziness in my wine trade. Maybe we can go into moonshine next, huh? No, thank you very much.
Anybody else have a question for Tom? Dex got a question.
Hi, Tom. Hi, Jack. Alcoholic. It's delightful to hear you talk. Thanks for being here. So you mentioned the guy who took you to Edinburgh and out to Waterford. I don't remember his name, but did you know that he was your quote sponsor at that point? Or was he just sort of your ambassador to AA, and how did he come to be your sponsor?
He was my contact from the answering service. I don't know whether I told you last week, but that damn ad that Means had in the paper just flashed at me at that point in my sobriety. So I called, and it was the answering service I got. Within a few minutes, I was plugged into Bob. Next day, I was at his home, and we talked for an hour, hour and a half, 2 hours, and decided that I did have an issue. I wasn't quite ready to give it up, but I did. Anyhow, we talked, and then he asked me to stay sober till Sunday night. I did that. I was very proud of myself that I could do it. And he came over with his girlfriend. Now, Bob was about my age now, 80, somewhere in there. And he had his girlfriend in the back seat, and Florence. I don't know if he was ever married. He never spoke of a wife or children. But he took me to Edinburgh, as I said, to get me to talk and him to talk. And one of those trips to Edinburgh or Wattsburg or whatever, he said, "Tom, you know, I'd like to sponsor you." And I said, "What's a sponsor?" That don't mean nothing to me. And his feelings were hurt. But I pestered the poor man to death until Jack's eye pained me. I was on the phone daily, if not two or three times a day, to him. And I wouldn't let him go. Now, he was just a very special man to me, and in his AA life, back in those times, you had to take a car to Akron or somewhere to get to a meeting, and you took a bunch of guys. Again, why the club is kind of important to me, because they'll do that down at the club too. But they'll get together in a car and head to Meadville to a meeting or somewhere where there's a picnic or anywhere. So that's kind of how I got introduced to Bob. And he remained my sponsor until he died. Jack Sibe come along and took over from that. But he was a great guy.
Anybody else? Anyone on Zoom? No? If not, thank you, Tom.
Oh, thank you.